Welcome to biblicalgenderroles.com. This will be the last episode I'm doing in this series, A Defense of Living Biblically. And this series was prompted by a atheist vlogger who didn't like some things that I wrote. Here I want to talk about, is the separation of church and state biblical? Okay, and now this is something that, you know, Americans in general cherish, and that, you know, I've grown up cherishing it, and, you know, it is a defining aspect of the country I live in, America, and really, it became a defining aspect even in Europe, because of what we did here. So the question is, as Christians, though, we can't just go by how we were raised or what our culture teaches, even our American culture, what Western culture teaches, modern Western culture. We have to go by what the Bible says. The Bible tells us we have to renew our minds according to what God says. And that basically means we have to many times unlearn what we've learned growing up, whether through our family or our culture, our state. And we have to learn what God says. So we're going to talk about this today, and I'm going to, as I get into here, I'll give some quotes from Rachel that she talked about, and then we're going to go from there. But so we want to answer this question, is separation of church and state biblical? I'll just start off by saying the answer to the question is yes, the church and state should be separate, but not in the way Americans understand it. Or Westerners understand it, and I'm going to explain that here in a minute here. What I want to talk about here is first that there's three spheres of authority, major spheres of authority that God has created, and then I'll swing back around and talk about why separation of church and state is biblical, but not in the way that we think. So the first sphere of authority that God created, really, was the family. In Ephesians 5, 22-24, God tells wives, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let wives be to their own husbands in everything. So that was Ephesians 5, 22-24. So that sets up the authority of the husband over the wife within the home, within the family. And then in Ephesians 6, 1-3, we read, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right, honor thy father and thy mother, which is the first commandment with promise that it may be well with thee and thou mayest live long on the earth. So children are within the sphere of the family, the authority sphere of the family. Children are to obey their mom and dad, and wives are to obey their husbands. So the mother's authority is delegated from the father, and the children obey the mother and the father, and the mother in the sense of that when she's obeying the father, and that's another subject for another blog here, another article that there may actually be some times where, hey, you know, mom's going way off from what the children know dad has said to do, and there may be some times where the kids have to not do what mom says to do what dad has said for the home, but that's another rabbit trail. We'll leave that for another day. But the sphere of the family, so God has established that. Okay, so then we get into the sphere of the church. In Hebrews 13, 17, speaking of church leaders, the Bible says, obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls as they that must give account, and that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. So you know, listen to your church leaders, obey your church leaders. You know, they're doing this for your benefit. Okay. So this is the authority of the church. Okay. And then the third sphere, major sphere of authority that God has created is the state. And in Romans 13:4, he says, this is the definition of why he gave us state, the civil government, okay? He says this in Romans 13:4, for he, speaking of the civil government, for he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. So the government is the minister of God to us for our good, and they are the minister of God as a revenger to execute evil, to execute wrath upon those that do evil. Okay, so when the Bible here says about the minister for good, well, I mean, we'll get into this a little bit more later. What is good? Well, good, when the Bible's talking about it, is good what God says is good. So the government is to promote what God says is good, to protect what God says is right to protect, and to enforce the laws that God has given. Okay? And so we have those three spheres. We have the family, and we have the church, and we have the state. Now, this brings us into the next question. Does the Bible teach the separation of church and state? And in this sense, which Jesus talks about it in the Gospel of Mark, the answer is yes. In Mark 12:17, Jesus says this, and Jesus answering said unto them, they asked him a question about paying taxes. And Jesus answering said unto them, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they marveled at him. So a lot of people will take this passage and they will, we need to pay taxes, which, yes, that's true. But, you know, they'll not realize that this passage is actually teaching the separation of church and state, in the sense that there are certain things God has given to the church, okay? There are certain things that belong to God and his ministers within the church, okay? And there are things that belong to the civil government that God has given to the civil government. So he didn't say here, give to God what is God's and everything else belongs to Caesar. So whatever God says is not my department, all of it, rest of it belongs to Caesar. He didn't say that. We get a lot of Christians, you know, there's other passages that talk about obey every ordinance of man, and those types of passages. And that is true, that we should obey our state and government laws. However, God has placed limits. God has given us a limited government in the sense of that he has given certain authority and responsibility to husbands and fathers in the home and the family. He has given certain authority and responsibility to the pastors and elders of churches, okay? And he has given certain authority and responsibility to the civil government. And those three are three separate areas with three separate powers. None of them have power over everything, okay? An example would be, I can't go out and set the speed limit, you know, on my going down the street here. My civil government sets the speed limit, okay? But can I tell my children, you know, you can or cannot, you know, watch this television show, or, you know, you can or cannot play this video game? In my home, can I set those? Yes. Yeah, so those, there's, it's a separate, you know, sphere of authority, separate responsibilities there, right? I'm not all powerful, and neither is the state. The state can't come in here and tell me how to raise my children, okay? And I can't go out there and say, here's how you build the freeway, okay? And the same thing with the church. You know, I when I attend church, I need to respect the way my elders are doing things at that church, and I can't stand up in the middle of a sermon, you know, I mean, unless, you know, there's like blatant blasphemy going on, you know, where somebody says Jesus isn't God or something, I'm going to stand up in that case. But, you know, when it comes to other debatable issues and convictions and applications of the scriptures, you know, how we apply things to our lives and they may apply it differently, I can't stand up and go, oh, well, you're applying that differently, and that's not the way I apply it. No, I need to respect the church. And if my pastor has certain dress standards for my kids when we go on church activities, we follow those, right? So it's a matter of recognizing the different powers of and the spheres of authority and the limits of those spheres with the family, the church, and the state. So the Bible absolutely teaches the concept of the separation and the distribution of powers and responsibilities between these three spheres. And as Christians, this is critical that we understand that, okay? And we also understand that too many Christians today believe in the concept of big government, of that the government is all powerful, and that there's God just reserves a few things like in the church, but the government can tell everybody what to do on everything. That is not true. Romans makes it very clear that the purpose of government is to minister for good, okay, to create laws to promote the common good as far as matching a biblical framework, okay, that's really what it's talking about, but also laws that don't go beyond its purpose, okay, in protecting the people, okay, and it's really there to enforce God's laws. And not to interfere in the home or in the church, okay? And any kind of laws which come from the government, which interfere with the authority of the home or the authority of the church, I've argued many times recently and even in the past, these can be rightly disregarded by the church and they can be rightly disregarded by the family. So just, you know, moving forward with this, yes, the Bible has these spheres of authority, but it also teaches the separation of powers. Okay. And in this, the separation of church and state, a lot of people today and Americans take this as, okay, not only does that mean that the church and state can't tell each other what to do, which is true. That's biblical. That's absolutely biblical. Okay. But they think that that means that the state has no part, no interest at all in promoting any type of religious beliefs. And that's where I believe America, as well as Western Europe, are wrong. Absolutely wrong. Okay? So it's right to say the state can't tell the church what to do, and the church can't tell the state what to do, but guess who can tell both of them what to do? God. God's sphere of authority. So I've said God created these three spheres of authority. These are human spheres, right? Family, church, state. Okay? But there's a sphere that surrounds all three of those. There's a sphere that surrounds the family, the church, and state spheres of authority. And that's God's authority. God is sovereign over everything. So the church is accountable to God. The state is accountable to God. The family is accountable to God. I, as the head of my home, the head of my wife, the head of my children, I am accountable to God. My pastor, my elders at my church are accountable to God. My president, my mayor, our government officials are accountable to God. All of them. So for Christians to say the state is not also accountable to God, just as the church and the family are, is a mistake. That is not biblical. That is wrong. Okay. So as Christians, we need to understand that. So yes, the United States government doesn't come in and tell my Baptist church or the Methodist church on the street what to do. But the state does have an interest in obeying, you know, from a state perspective, promoting and having the obedience of the people to God's moral laws. I mean, like enforcing things like the Ten Commandments, nine of them, because the Sabbath law is not brought forward in the New Testament. But, you know, enforcing, there should be absolutely no problem with a court having a plaque, you know, even of the Ten Commandments, understanding, you know, that the Sabbath law doesn't come forward. But the thing is that we shouldn't have any issues with that. That's not a contradiction. That's not a problem. And even the state promoting the unity of faith, that's not a problem. So that's all, a lengthy introduction. Now I'm going to get more into the meat here, and I'm going to get back to some more of these concepts that I've talked about here. So going back to Rachel Oates, her atheist site, okay? She made a statement in response to something that I said in my article, Why God Wants You to Stay in an Abusive Relationship. I said this. I said, the civil government must always be respectful of its limitations when it enters the sphere of the church or the home. This means that they must never usurp or take authority in matters which God has not given to the government, but instead he has given to the church or the home. We just talked about that a little bit ago. So Rachel says in her vlog, she says, no. She says, like, you know, I think six no's. And she says, honestly, I don't think religion should get involved in political issues or lawmaking or anything like that. What exactly gives Christians this authority over all other religions? Okay. I'll talk a little bit about more about that later as far as Christians' authority over all other religions. Okay. But the idea that religion shouldn't be involved in politics at all. Okay. If you really look at it, religion is more than just a belief in God. Okay. I mean, and there's other different religions that believe in different gods, right? It is also a framework, a set of values. It is a basis for values, okay? It is a philosophy of values, all right? And so, like, yeah, I mean, our faith informs our values. I mean, the reason we have many of the laws today is because of what people believe was right and wrong based on their faith. Now, today we're trying to separate those things, but really, you can't separate those things. So even the government has to have a basis for, okay, why do we believe these certain things are wrong? Why do we say this is wrong or this is immoral or this is, you know, we have to have that basis for that. And faith, religion, gives us that basis. So to say that law shouldn't be based in religion, I'm sorry, but that's a basis for why we do or don't do things. And, you know, secularists will talk about, well, we'll do what works for a functioning society. I'm going to get into that next here. Okay. I kind of jumped ahead, but that's well, we're going to come to that here. So I made another statement and then here's Rachel's response to that. I said, the civil government must always be respectful. Oh, this is the other one I read, of its limitations when it enters the sphere of the church or the home. And then I said underneath that statement, when the government attempts to usurp authority in the church or the home, Christians have the God-given right and in most cases the responsibility to exercise civil disobedience against such usurpation. God has appointed pastors as the interpreters of God's moral law in the church assembly, and he has appointed husbands as the interpreters of God's moral law in the home. Okay, so the church or the state does not have the authority to come into my home and tell me how to raise my children. Okay, the church does not have the authority to come into my home or the state doesn't have authority to come into my home and tell me about my wife and me. Okay, and marriage is something that was given to the family. Raising the children was something that was given to the family. Okay. So Rachel says here in response to what I just said, she says, now take the same sentence. So what he said about Christians, take the same sentence and replace Christians with Muslims. Okay. So when I said, when the government attempts to usurp authority in the church or the home, I'm going to replace that with Muslims. Muslims have the God-given right and in most cases the responsibility to exercise civil disobedience against such usurpation. Okay, all right. So she says, if you did that, this guy I can guarantee you would be throwing a fit. You tell one religious group they are above the law, and then suddenly every religious group thinks they're above the law, and then you end up with chaos. The law is there for a reason, and it's above and separate from religion. Sorry, but that's how you ensure a functioning society. Okay, so that term functioning society, that is a common phrase if you go to humanist and atheist websites when they talk about how they get their morality, okay, and how they come up with what they think are, you know, moral right things for people to do and how to live, okay? The question is, what actually does work? What actually does make for a functioning society? I'll come back to that in just a second, but let me come back to this just for the sake of conversation. If we replaced Muslims in that sentence, they have the God-given right and responsibility to exercise civil disobedience. Okay, from one perspective, I could kind of see that. Yes, that each family, each home has to operate with what they believe is right and moral and just. Okay? So we all have to do what we think is right. Now, sometimes what we think is right in our family may conflict with our culture and our society and the laws of our culture. So we may have to accept the possibility. We have to accept that, hey, if I do this and my government finds out that I do this, I could be arrested. I could be put, there's countries that were imprisoning Christians for worshiping God. Communist countries did it. Atheists, communists arrested Christians for following their faith. China, they're starting to let up now a little bit, but they've persecuted Christians for years. Okay. You have to do what you believe is right. And so, yes, from one perspective, yeah, a Muslim or an atheist, and I know you're like in shock, like, oh, he said that, but each family, each person must do what they believe is right before God, but understanding that sometimes there are consequences for that. If what you believe is right, it conflicts with your authority, okay, you may face consequences for that. You know, I'm the spiritual head of my home, and one of my children may disagree with some standards I have here. And if they break some of my rules and they're like, hey, well, this is my standard and I think I can do this. Well, you go ahead and do that and you act on your conscience. But if I think it's bad, you're probably going to get punished. And if I do something that my state believes is wrong, I'm probably going to get punished. If I get caught, I'm going to get punished. Okay, so we do, as Christians, we accept that possibility. So from a certain perspective, yes, I can understand, you know, a Muslim acting out his faith. Now, I believe it's a false faith. I don't believe it's true as Christianity is, and even an atheist acting out what he thinks. But again, is it true? Is it equal? No, I don't think it is. But the concept of people acting on their conscience, yes, to a certain extent, I definitely can see that. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I have to act within my faith, within my belief structure. And if that brings me into conflict with my culture, with my family, with my government, then it does. So be it. So she's really concerned here with chaos. That, oh, we're gonna break into chaos if all the families, if everybody, you know, if every individual family did what they thought was right, you know, that the law, the civil law, because that's what she's talking about. The law is above, it's above and separate from religion. Okay, well, for us as Christians, I'm sorry, but the laws of the government of the United States are not above the laws of God. Or if we live in the UK, the laws of the UK are not above the laws of God. So if the laws of the UK don't conflict with God's laws and they don't step outside the authority that God has given to civil government, then we obey them. But if they go against what God says, or they step outside the authority and they usurp authority and enter into the family sphere or the church, then we practice civil disobedience and we disobey those laws. Absolutely. So it's a very clear delineation here. So but this doesn't mean that, you know, that we don't believe in laws. And this is what Rachel was kind of putting out there. Like, I don't believe in civil laws or anything. I'm like, I do. I absolutely do. But again, as long as those laws don't conflict with what God says in the Bible, and as long as those laws aren't them going outside of what the authority that God has given them, we obey them. You know, this is what the speed limit is. We obey the speed limit. We pay our taxes. We, you know, those kind of things. We obey those things. If the city has a building code, you got to get, we obey that. Okay. So those things are reasonable. We understand that. But when she says here, like a functioning society, what she's talking about is and this is the belief in secular government. Okay. That you can have a society with all kinds of different religions, and everyone will just live peaceably together, and you won't have a problem. Well, we're finding out now in America and in other countries that that's not the case. that there are conflicts, that there are conflicts between what Christians believe and Muslims believe and atheists believe. And we've been fighting about it for the last century or so, that since secularism has taken over in the courts and everything else, battling back and forth. We have in the United States now, people being threatened with lawsuits if they won't serve a homosexual, if a cake maker won't make a cake for a homosexual wedding, or if a photographer won't. I mean, we have these conflicts. So, you know, the idea that you can have these very different philosophies all existing in one country, that doesn't really work for a functioning society. And we're thinking we can make that work, but it doesn't. And I'm gonna get more into that here. I put this quote on my blog several times. This quote is from Victor Davis Hanson. He wrote a article entitled "America History's Exception" for National Review back in June 9th of 2016. And you can find most of the things I'm quoting here in a new article I did a little while back called "The Case for Christian Nationalism." So just read that article, because pretty much everything I'm saying in here, most of it is in that article. Okay. So he says here, Victor Davis Hanson says this: "The history of nations is mostly characterized by ethnic and racial uniformity, not diversity. Most national boundaries reflected linguistic, religious, and ethnic homogeneity. Until the 20th century, diversity was considered a liability, not a strength. Countries ancient and modern that have tried to unite diverse tribes have usually fared poorly. The Italian Roman Republic lasted 500 years. In contrast, the multiracial Roman Empire that after the Edict of Caracalla in AD 212 made all its diverse peoples equal citizens endured little more than two often violent centuries." So it's saying, if you look at the Roman Empire, when it was an Italian Republic and the Italians ruled over all of the other nations that were within their empire, okay, they had unity, they had stability. As soon as the Roman Empire went multicultural and it made all of its citizens, all the people from all the nations, equal citizens, and started having representatives in their government from all the different provinces and everything, it collapsed, and the violence came about, all kinds of things happened. Okay, multiculturalism does not work. You have to have a unified culture, and you have to have a unified culture, like I said in my article, "The Case for Christian Nationalism," based on three things: common religion, common ethnicity, and common language. Those three things unite a people, and they have since the history of mankind. When you mess with that mixture, you get division, you get war, civil wars within a country, you get all kinds of problems, okay? And I'm not saying that civil wars are always over those things, but in most cases, they are. When you allow sectarianism to come in to play, and you allow divisive religious type things, and you allow divisive ethnicity to come in, and you allow diverse languages, things begin to break down. Okay, what we preach today, oh, this is wonderful, this is great, while we have people in our streets rioting, Europe doesn't know what to do with the massive Muslim influx that it's had, because they can't say no, because if they do, oh, they're bigoted and they're evil and they're bad. It's wrong for them to protect their cultures. That's what we're told. It's wrong. America can't do it. Oh, they're bigoted, bad. Oh, we should just all be able to. But it violates human nature. It violates the concept of what a nation is about. So that's why, as I said a little earlier, I absolutely believe that while the civil government can't tell the church, individual churches, what to do, the civil government can, in obedience to God, the civil government can set general policy to say, hey, we are a Christian nation. Now, we're not going to come in and tell you, Baptist church, what to do and how to baptize and how to organize your services and you know what your positions on prophecy are and all these things. And we're not going to come into you, Methodist Church, and tell you how to conduct your services, or you, Lutheran Church. But we can say we are a Christian nation. We can, the government can say we are a Christian nation founded on biblical values. And there are certain central Christian beliefs and moral values that we as the state will enforce that should not be debatable amongst churches. Now, there's lots of other things that are. It still leaves tons of room for freedom, but it unites a people around a common belief system, a common set, something that gives you a common basis for your morals. Today, we can't even in the United States or in Europe, we cannot even agree on the basis of morality. What was immoral 20 years ago is now just perfectly fine today because we cannot agree on what the basis of morality is. But when you have a common religion where the government says, not getting into denominations and specific churches, but when you agree on a basic common faith, that, hey, we are Christian. We are a Christian nation. We are an English-speaking nation, and I know people will say, oh, you're racist, but we were founded by primarily British people, really, honestly, in the beginning. If you look at the census from the 1700s, I mean, you're talking like 85, 90% British, you know, whether it was Scottish, Welsh, English. I mean, Protestant, you know, Christians, white Protestant, and I know that people don't like that when I say that. They, oh, you're, it's horrible. That's horrible. But that's what, that is the historical truth. Okay? And this is how societies have operated, and we think we can change that formula. And that's what we've done. And we see this, just the total divisions within societies in Europe and in the United States and other places trying to do that. We've broken down what unites peoples. Okay? So, I just want to talk about, you know, some things that John Adams, one of our founding fathers, said about the United States. Decades before, well, even before the United States was formed, he said this. Before the American Revolution, this was several decades when John Adams was young, very young man, he wrote this in his personal diary. He said, suppose a nation in some distant region should take for the Bible, for their only law book, should take the Bible for their only law book, and every member should regulate his conduct by the precepts there exhibited. What a utopia. What a paradise that would be. I mean, this young man, this young John Adams, is basically describing a theonomy, a government that is based upon biblical law. And he's saying what a great society that would be. And then in the decades that followed the birth of our nation, he wrote this in a letter to Thomas Jefferson. So John Adams said this to Thomas Jefferson. The general principles on which the fathers achieved independence, the founding fathers achieved independence, were the general principles of Christianity. I will avow that I then believed and now believe that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and the attributes of God. So he's saying, okay, yes, we did have secularists in there, but he's saying we, you know, and Thomas Jefferson, you know, wasn't exactly a Bible-believing Christian, okay? But he's saying to Thomas Jefferson, the principles upon which we established this nation were in fact Christian principles, okay? And John Adams wrote this quote in response to Thomas Paine, big secularist, in response to his Age of Reason. John Adams said, the Christian religion is, above all religions that ever prevailed or existed in ancient or modern times, the religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. Let the blackguard Paine, that's his way of insulting him, say what he will. In other words, let him say what he will, but you know what? We know what the truth is. And we know the truth of Christianity and that our nation was founded on that. Okay, so, and there was other quotes that I have in my article where, and there's more that I didn't even put there, of founding fathers, many founding fathers who had a problem, big problems with Thomas Paine. He was not exactly this loved person by all the founders, as some people try and act like. They were basically shocked and just like dismayed at things that he wrote. That was not what they intended, even with freedom of religion. That was not they didn't want people turning to secularism. They highly discouraged it, the founding fathers did. But really, honestly, atheists in America can actually thank a Baptist preacher named John Leland for really giving us separation of church and state in the Constitution. The Baptists were heavily persecuted in the colonies. Most of the colonies had state religions, Anglican or Congregationalism, and the Baptists were badly treated by these state churches. And so because of him, the history, his background, when he came from, he had a big problem, with the church being involved with the state at all. And I would agree with him to a certain level that yes, that they were wrong in many of the things that they did, that they got involved in things like what I said, where the government shouldn't be, like how do you baptize, how do you conduct your services, how do you do different. The government should not be involved in the church store there. That is usurping their power. They should not be involved at that point. The government should not be collecting taxes for a state church and distributing it out that way. But so I would agree with him on that. But he went too far, and he heavily influenced Madison in to get the First Amendment the way that it was written. Okay, in 1791, Leland wrote this, and this influenced Madison, and he also worked. Leland worked very closely with Thomas Jefferson as well on this. Is conformity of sentiments in matters of religion essential to the happiness of civil government? This is the Baptist preacher John Leland writing this. Not at all. Government has no more to do with the religious opinions of men than it has with the principles of mathematics. Let every man speak freely without fear, maintaining the principles that he believes, worshiping according to his own faith, either one God, three gods, no God, or 20 gods. And let government protect him in doing so, i.e., see that he meets with no personal abuse or loss of property for his religious opinions. Instead of discouraging him with prescriptions, fines, confiscation of death, let him be encouraged as a free man to bring forth his arguments and maintain his points with all boldness. Then, if his doctrine is false, it will be confuted, and if it is true, though ever so novel, let others credit it. When every man has this liberty, what more can he wish for? A liberal man asks for nothing more of government. So, I mean, he literally, and this influenced Madison, with the First Amendment. He literally is saying, hey, we should be perfectly fine with atheists, with polytheists, with Muslims, with, and in another statement, I mean, he basically talked about that. So it's not a problem that we should have no, the government should not be involved in protecting any type of religious, not protecting Christianity, not protecting any type of religious belief system at all. Okay. And that literally opened the door for secularism in America, even though the founders weren't secularists and they didn't like secularism, as with Thomas Paine. But they opened the door because they were trying to protect from the abuses of the colonial church state governments that even I would agree went way overboard and usurped their authority, that things that don't belong to the state government, they went too far over. I mean, we'll often find that in societies that to because of an abuse of a certain area, we swing too far one way or the other, right? We have to be careful of that. And unfortunately, our founders went too far. The colonial state governments were maybe too far to the right, taking too much power as far as in the sense of trying to enforce religious unity. Okay, which the general principle is good, but they went way, way, way too far. Okay, and yet we swung the pendulum all the way to the left, going, okay, The state's going to have nothing to say about the religious unity of the people. The state is not going to protect at all the religious unity of the United States. That's what happened. And that, I believe, I love my country. I love America. But that was a fatal flaw in our founding. It absolutely was. We stood by as Christians and we watched as atheists and secularists and others from other faiths took over our nation. We're sitting literally sitting here watching Muslims come in by the thousands, building mosques all over our country, and we can't say anything about it because of our unbiblical belief that the government has no place protecting any type of religious unity in our country. They have no place protecting Christianity, the general faith of Christianity, as the faith of our country. That is false. And that is going to be one of the factors that leads to the fall of the United States, which I believe is coming. Whether it's in the next century or so, it is coming. It's one of the reasons that we will fall. Just as Rome fell because of it lost its unity, it lost its identity, we are losing our identity, we are losing our unity. We hear politicians all the time talk about, on the left and the right, the language is the language of civil war. Liberals, I've heard liberals saying it, I've heard conservatives saying it. The language we have in our politics over the last, not just Trump, but way before that, it's the language of civil war. So, and we've brought this on ourselves. This was, I love our founders, but this was, unfortunately, they left the door wide open for secularism, and it's really a fatal flaw. But I do want to bring up something, though, about Leland, this Baptist preacher Leland, and Jefferson, to prove something, that they didn't really believe in the separation of church and state the way we have twisted it and made it. There was a man named Richard Land who gave a speech on Jefferson and on freedom of speech, or freedom of religion, I'm sorry. And he said this at Beeson Divinity School on May 2nd, 2000. Okay. He said, clearly Jefferson saw no contradiction between his concept of church and state separation and having a gift personally presented to him at the White House with a promise of continued prayer by the prominent Baptist preacher, that was Leland. On the very morning, he wrote to the Danbury Baptist, that's the famous one that was, the famous letter that was quoted by the Supreme Court for separation of church and state. So when he wrote that famous statement about the wall between the church and the state, okay, less than 48 hours later, he was attending a Sunday morning worship service where the minister, John Leland, the guy we just talked about, the letting atheists and letting everybody else do their thing, okay, where he preached in the well of the U.S. House of Representatives. Literally was preaching a sermon on a Sunday in the House of Representatives. So apparently they didn't believe in separation of church and state the way the Supreme Court the next century later took it. So even, but again, they laid the groundwork for that to happen. They left the door open and secularists moved in, seized it, took it, and ran with it. So with all that being said, so we're coming back to this idea of a functioning society, what's best for a functioning society that humanists and atheists will often talk about. Let's have morality that's best for a functioning society. That's how we come up with what's right and wrong and how things work. Okay, well, let me give you a few facts and see how well secularism has worked for America. Okay, secularism really began to take hold in the United States in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Okay, and I want to read you some facts and some things that have happened since that point. In 1929, over 95% of children were born to married mothers, but by 2008, that number was reduced to only 59.4%. In the U.S., only 6.4% of, this is talking about the importance of marriage here. In the U.S., only 6.4% of married two-parent families live below the poverty level, while 36.5% of single-parent female-headed families live in poverty. And then when we include single-parent male-led families and also families where the man and the woman live together, but they're unmarried. That number goes up to 71.2% of unmarried families that live at or below the poverty level. Okay? So marriage has a direct impact economically, and I would even argue socially, spiritually, morally, on a nation. And marriage has been massively degraded by our culture embracing secularism over the last century, more than a century. We embraced feminism and all of these other movements and atheism and evolution in our schools. We threw prayer out of the schools, and we have watched as the family has just been decimated and eroded, and people are just, you know, let's just do whatever makes us happy. You know, if this makes me happy, if I want to sleep with this guy or this girl or this guy and this girl, if I want to have a relationship with them, or if I want to be married for 3 years to this one, divorce this one, my personal happiness, our personal happiness, just whatever pleasure we want to do, that's what it's all about now. And we've forgotten about duty and sacrifice, which are the things which build a nation, which are the things that build families. Okay? And we are watching the decimation of the family unit, which is the building block of any society. If you don't have strong families, your country will eventually collapse. When marriage collapses, the nation will collapse. That's why I've said to people, you know, it's coming. And you don't have to be a prophet to say that. I'm not saying I'm a prophet. You just look at the writing on the wall and look what's happening. I mean, and even, you know, if you look at the fertility rate, I talk about this a lot on my site. America's fertility rate is at 1.84 children per woman. And it needs to be a minimum of 2.1, and some people say 2.33 per woman, children born per woman, just to keep your population level, not really growing, okay? And if you want it to kind of grow, you probably got to get up at 2.5, maybe 2.4, 2.5, even into the threes to really get it growing nice and good. Okay. So and this is happening across Europe. This 1.84, they're even lower in Europe than some countries. And Japan's like 1.4, I believe. But I mean, as the rest of the world starts embracing Western liberalism, feminism, secularism, the family unit is decimated. Children are not raised by moms and dads. Children are not raised by their mom at home like they were, okay? From the time they're young, mom has a baby. She rushes out to work. If she does have a baby at all, you have one or two kids and you're done. That's not enough. And we need moms at home. All of that has been just decimated, okay? And if we continue in this, I encourage you to Google. I'm going to be using this for some upcoming things I'm working on. A study done by the United Nations back in 2004, I want to say. If you just look up world population 2300, you'll find this study, okay? And it was a very in-depth study that the United Nations did. And it was the longest outlooking study as far as population trends. And they show that if the world continues down the path of westernization, and if all the nations of the world follow the paths of Europe and the United States, and they go to having 1.8 children per family or somewhere around there, okay? The population of the world by 2300 will go from, we're now, you know, up into the, you know, 7-something billion. It's going to go down to 2.3 billion, I believe I read. You can read the study. And it will continue to decline. And it was showing that native Europeans will be down to like less than 5% of the population of Europe. Like Europe will basically be African and maybe Middle Eastern. Like the actual native populations of Europe will like almost be gone. If we continue down this route that we're doing, if we continue down the secularist, you know, individualist, like I'm just going to live my life for myself, my own self-fulfillment, I'm not going to think of what is best for society, what's best for my nation. I'm not going to think what's best for my family. I'm just going to do whatever I want to do. Okay? That's what we're following today. And we're looking at the destruction, the self-destruction of our own cultures because of what we're doing here. Okay? So we really, really, really need to think about this. And now, you know, that same study, you know, some people look at it, well, yeah, that's true, but they also said, you know, if we continue, you know, if world fertility rates, some of these places have 3 per woman or whatever, if it continues at 2.5 or 2.7, and with lifespans increasing and, you know, we don't have children dying the way we once did it with infant mortality, we could have, you know, 100 trillion people, you know, by 2300, okay? And I don't know if that math is quite true, but let's just say we even get into the trillions of people and they say, oh, the Earth can't support that. Well, they've been saying that if you look back, you know, even, you know, before modern times, all the inventions, all the things, I encourage you to look up a concept called carrying, I believe it's called carrying capacity, okay? That the ingenuity of human beings to make their environment support more life is God has put this gift in us and this ability that every time we think, we're not going to have enough resources, we're in our room, we find these ways to just blow the doors off of any limits that we have. Okay. And at the end of the day, honestly, God knows when he's coming back and what the true capacity of Earth is. And God knows what he's doing. If he tells us, hey, we're supposed to be fruitful and multiply, that was the first command given to mankind, that is what he said to do. So unless God calls us to celibacy in his service, that is what we are to do, period. And God will provide. God will provide us with the ideas for resources, for living spaces. And you know what? Honestly, I mean, I love sci-fi stuff, and I was reading a lot of things lately about, you know, the abilities that we would have to, you know, go out and colonize Mars, colonize other planets and things like that, that if we had kept the resources as we did from the NASA projects, we just cut all the funding. We would have already been colonizing Mars by now if we were spending the amount of money that we spent in the 60s getting to the moon. We just choose not to. We're spending it on all kinds of other things here. Okay? But if people were concentrating, if the governments of the world were concentrating on that, I mean, basically, we would never run out of room, whether it's orbital living on the moon, Mars, other planets. I mean, there's absolutely no reason for people to stop having children. The only reason we have starvation in the world, I really encourage you to look this up. Like, there's some great sites about, you know, overpopulation myths and things like that. Just look it up. And I mean, the reason that we have food shortages, the reason that we have resource shortages, is because of corrupt governments. It's because of people choosing, or space shortages, because people just choose to smash themselves into cities when they don't have to. Okay? I mean, there's a lot of reasons for these things that are, we're running out of space. No, we're not. It's just because sometimes we stupidly conduct ourselves and stupidly manage ourselves. Okay? But God knew what he was doing. God created this world. He gave us a mandate, and we need to follow that mandate. So I think, you know, if we look back, you know, at the history of nations, and we can see that nations were strongest when they were united around a common religion, common ethnicity, and common language. And when any one of those three pillars started to fall, the nation would fall. So and the government can protect a common faith while still allowing for freedom within that faith. And I'm not even arguing, I mean, I'm going to get more into this in some upcoming things I talk about. I'm not even arguing that, you know, we necessarily have to, you know, go into people's homes and arrest someone if they're an atheist or a Muslim or things like that. That's not what I'm talking about. But in the same token, the promotion of Christianity, the protection of Christianity as the unifying part of a society, you know, maybe I wouldn't be opposed to saying, hey, if you're not Christian, you need to keep that private. The way that Christians today, look what's happened to Christians today. We're forced to keep our Christian faith private. Oh, if you want to, you believe you're Christian, you keep that at home. We don't want to hear about that. But you know what? If you're a seculars and atheists, feel free to talk anywhere you want. You know, any other faith or religion, you can say or do whatever you want. But if you're a Christian, you need to keep that at home. Or, you know, sometimes even any religion, you need to keep that private. Okay. All right. So no, I would like to see a society to where no, Christianity is proudly spoken of. And if you're not a Christian, you keep that private. I mean, we're not going to come into your house and arrest you for not going to church. I don't believe anyone should be forced to go to church. I mean, we only want true believers, you know, joining a church, okay? But at the same token, we don't have to allow mosques, say, to be built in our neighborhoods. We don't have to allow atheists to march down the street saying there is no God. You guys are idiots if you believe in God, or getting bulletin boards to say there is no God. We don't have to allow that. We don't have to. We could say you could go back to the closet where you were. I mean, we're not going to come in and arrest you, but and people say, oh, well, you can't have that. Well, I'm just saying that the model we have right now is not working. It's not working. And but I will say this, and I want to say this before I end here, that I had some of your reviews, my site a lot recently, accused me of, biblical gender roles is advocating for overthrowing the U.S. government. I never said that. I've never said that. But what I've said is I do think that the government will collapse eventually. And I honestly think it's going to come in stages. I think it's going to happen through states seceding, because you've got this massive civil war, cultural civil war going on. And I'm not the only one saying this. I mean, major people in news media are saying this, okay? And you're going to have states seceding. We've already had states talking about it with President Trump getting elected. We're going to have more states talking about this. And if we get socialists back in to power like Obama, you're going to see it from the other side. And if they assault things like the God-given right to keep and bear arms and defend your family, if they assault religious freedom, if they start, you know, I saw a movie the other day in the video store, and it's kind of pushing it, like Created Equal, I think it was called, where it shows this fictional story of a woman suing the Catholic Church to make them allow Catholic women to be Catholic priests. That, I believe, is coming. That is actually coming, I think. Or people suing churches to say you can't preach against homosexuality, or you have to allow homosexual members, you can't quote-unquote discriminate, okay? That's coming. And when those things happen, that will cause a breakup of the United States, because the more conservative evangel, and guess it's kind of funny with the Civil War, it'll be almost the same states, but some more. The most conservative states in the United States, the ones that have the most evangelicals, are in fact the southern states and some of the midwestern states. So it'll be interesting to see what would happen with the northwest states. But yeah, I mean, there's a big cultural civil war going on in this country, especially between what we call like the left coasts and the middle of the country. And I honestly, I tell my children, I tell other people, you're going to see a civil war in the next century in the United States. You will see a breakup. So I'm not advocating for the overthrow of the United States government. However, if they started doing some of these things of taking away our right to bear arms, saying Christians have to allow homosexuals to join the churches, you can't preach against it, saying churches have to have female ministers or else they're just... I wouldn't be against secession. If they put up a vote and said, hey, you want to secede from the United States? Because I wouldn't be against it. I mean, because they would be breaking these cardinal things that we cannot go along with. We can't. So, and at that point, what's left of the United States? So, I mean, these things are going to happen. It's unfortunate, but our founding fathers, I like I said, I mean, I love their intent. I love the faith of many of them. But they left open this fatal flaw. They left open this fatal crack in our system that allowed for secularism to just take root and just grow up like a poison in our country, that just basically just changed this country into something its founders would never recognize. based upon the laws. You can see the laws they passed in the 1700s and the early 1800s, and then you can see where we've shifted from there. We don't even look anything like them anymore. Our culture does not look anything like that anymore. So, again, you know, this was, you know, my last article, or I'm sorry, my last video in this series, you know, toward Rachel here. Just I want to kind of answer her positions about government and to just say, yes, I believe in government, but I don't believe government is all powerful. I don't believe government is above everything. I believe that the church, the state, the family are all underneath God's authority, all of them. And they each have their own spheres. They each have their own things. And the church cannot interfere in the things given to the state. And the state cannot interfere in the things given to the church. And neither the church nor the state can interfere in the things that are given to God by the family. It really is that simple. So I hope this will be a blessing to you. I know some people will be disturbed by, you know, the things that I've said about our culture, but it's true and it's biblical. Or the fact that this country, we love it. I love it. But the fact that it's going to collapse in the coming century, most likely. But it's because we've left God's ways. We've left the Christian principles that this country was founded on. So I just pray that, you know, each of you will take this to heart. And, you know, we just have to prepare our families. We have to prepare for what will come in the future. I'm not advocating for, you know, Christian militias to form up. I'm not talking about that, but I do see probably some kind of secession, civil war, or something occurring in the next. It's too different. Secularism and Christianity cannot coexist, and we're proving it. It cannot coexist. Nations must be united around common religion, common faith, and common ethnicity. I didn't really hit that here today because that really wasn't the point of it. But I mean, look at the riots we've had over decades. Look at a lot of the problems we have, the continual problems that we have. So I really do think that we need to think about those things. But I hope this has been a blessing to you, and thank you for listening.